encourage students and feedback to the teacher. You know, giving feedback to the teacher about how they're doing most improves student learning. And again, for a conference experience, what's most going to improve the conference experience for you people into the future is feedback to the conference organisers. So, you know, with that, I wish you well. You have a great conference and enjoy.
Thanks, Peter. It's my pleasure to welcome Mark Pesci, who is here by arrangement with Paxton Speakers International. Mark is an inventor, writer, educator, and broadcaster. He's done some marvellous things. In 1994, he co-invented VRML. That's a 3D interface for the World Wide Web. He's written 5 books, including The Playful World, How Technology is Transforming Our Imagination, a book which gives insight into our interactive future. As an educator, Mark founded graduate programs in interactive media at both the University of Southern California's world-famous cinema school and the Australian Film, Radio and Television School. For the last 6 years, Mark has been a panellist, you've probably seen him, and judge on the ABC's hit series, The New Inventors, as well as a regular commentator on technology and society for Triple J Pack, 7:30 Report, 7 PM Project, and ABC Global Radio. In 2006, Mark founded Future Street, a Sydney consultancy dedicated to helping clients negotiate the challenges presented by our hyper-connected future. Today, Mark will present a keynote focused on the next billion seconds in education. Thank you, Mark, and welcome.
Good morning, everybody. You know, I wish I was at a conference where someone handed me an iPad when I walked in. I have to say, sounds fun. So what I want to do is talk about some of the research that I've been working on. I'm actually writing my 6th book right now, which is going to be called The Next Billion Seconds. The thesis of the book is that the billion seconds, that's 31 years, between 1995 and 2026, will be as transformative to the human species as the birth of language was 60,000 years ago. Now, I'm not going to go into all of that argument, but what I'm going to do is touch on what this actually means for education. Now, I don't teach full-time. I teach a couple of lectures a year at Sydney University, and at the beginning of last month, I had a chance to teach one of my lectures. And when I did that, I always view it as an opportunity. If I'm doing my job well, I will learn as much from the students as they can learn from me. Often what that means is I simply watch what they're doing. And you as educators can watch what your kids are doing with all of the technology that they have. And you can learn about new behaviors because they're practically going to be the first people who are going to express those new behaviors because they're all watching each other. And once one of them learns something new, it spreads like wildfire. And so that's what I often do. When I'm working in the classroom, I'll look at what the kids are doing. Other times, particularly when I'm doing a lecture, I realize that I have a captive audience. And so I run an ethnographic survey, as if I were an anthropologist out in the field. And so I had 80 students in the room, and so I asked them a series of questions. And the first thing I asked them is, how old are you? And they scattered around 18, 19 years old, about what you'd expect for a second year class at Sydney University. Then I asked them, how old were you when you got your first mobile? And at average day, as you can see, there's a peak between 11, 12, and 13 years old when they got their first mobile. And when I charted it all out, it meant that 50% of the kids in that room had a mobile by the time they were 11 and a half years old. I did this analysis, and I tweeted the results, and I connected to a lot of educators on Twitter, and some of them came back to me and said, Mark, seems a little bit old, actually. And of course it should, because this survey is actually looking 8 years into the past. These kids have already had mobile phones for 8 years, since 2003, when I arrived in Australia. So if we want to look at a survey that's focused more around the present moment, it's a survey that was completed in America last year. It shows how much has changed in just the last 8 years. In this survey, 37% of students between kindy and year two already have a mobile, one-fifth have a smartphone. By year eight, 85%, with fully one-third using smartphones. That figure is probably higher in Australia, because Australia has higher smartphone penetration than any other nation in the world. We are the first nation in the world to have reached 50% smartphone penetration. That's happening right now. Now, the mobile was introduced 30 years ago last month, 1981. And since it was first introduced, the average age of first ownership has dropped and dropped. For 20 years, the device was simply too expensive to give it to a child, unless it were a child of a very wealthy family. But now, you can go into, say, Crazy John's or Telstra store and buy an Android smartphone outright for $100 and spend $20 or $30 a month on a plan for it, which means that, with the exception of the poorest Australians, everyone in Australia can now afford a smartphone. And as that price barrier has dropped, hand in hand, the age of first mobile ownership has dropped and dropped from, say, 11 and a half in 2003 to something that's closer to 8 years old today. And I'm interested, after I give my talk today, if you want to come up and talk to me about what you think your average age is when your kid's first starting in their mobiles, because I'm constantly trying to get a bead on that and how that is changing. And so if you could tell me that, that would help me a lot in my research. Now, there's been resistance to the adoption of the mobile in the sub-8-year-old set because the devices themselves aren't particularly well designed to children with less developed cognitive skills. Now, the funny thing is that's actually changed because the smarter a phone has gotten, the easier it is for a child to use. If you think about it, a 2-year-old will now often take mom or dad's iPhone out of their pocket and start tapping away at it to get to the games. And if they're not careful, sometimes they'll make a phone call. And so as touch devices become more capable, the barrier to entry that kept kids from using phones started dropping. But phones are not particularly well suited to the needs, the communication needs of a young child. They haven't really been designed for that. The market hasn't been mature enough to support a whole bunch of specifically child-friendly devices. And the carriers haven't developed plans for children who basically are only going to use it to call mom. But this is going to happen. This is the direction that the market is heading, because as we push downward, the resistance is being designed away. People are coming up with mobiles that are designed specifically for these age groups. And there's no real end in sight for this. The younger the child, the more that the mobile assumes the role of a benevolent watcher, a sensor that reports the condition of the child to the parent. I was staying with some friends in East Bentley the other night. They have a 1-year-old. And they put the child to bed, and we sat down to have dinner, and they had their baby monitor. And you're all familiar with baby monitors, only this is the latest and greatest nth generation baby monitor. So not only is it a radio, but it's also got the child's temperature and breathing rate being transmitted from the other room. It's $250, but that's exactly where this is going. And so we already use that electronic tether to keep a track of the child. And the mobile provides exactly the same capability by slightly different technological means. And so where the mobile is going is that it's turning into a sensor for the very young that tracks the child's heartbeat, temperature, any other vital statistics. It will grow smaller. It will grow less power hungry until at some point in the next 15 years, a child's going to get their first mobile because it's going to be embedded in the name tag that gets slipped on their foot when they pop out of the womb. And that's an absolute inevitability. And the other absolute inevitability that follows from that is that within the next decade, every child entering every primary school everywhere in Australia will be bearing their own mobile. They will join the rest of us in being hyper-connected. They will be directly and immediately connected to everyone of importance for them. And why should Australian children be any different than any of the rest of us? Have a guess. What is the mobile subscription rate in Australia? Someone want to shout out some numbers? What percentage of Australians have mobile subscriptions? You're low. Bingo! Give that man a gold star. Around 120%. And you've got to remember that the very oldest and the very youngest Australians do not have mobile subscriptions in general. But of course, I'm sitting here, I've got my iPad, it's got a subscription, I've got my iPhone in my pocket, that's got another subscription, I've got a little wireless thingy. And so we have multiple devices that have multiple subscriptions. And that's not changing, that's only getting more so. In 5 years' time, that number will be 200%, and so on and so on. Within a generation, being connected and being human will be synonymous. That is the main theme of the book that I'm working on. And in the next couple of years, say the next decade, in the time between when we were, before we were all connected and the time when we just assume that we're all connected, we have a moment to make some pedagogical and institutional adjustments to this pervasively connected culture that we're barreling into. Now, that same survey that I was talking about found that at the kindergarten level, two-thirds of parents were willing to buy their children a mobile phone if the device had been integrated into the pedagogy. But the survey also pointed to opposition to this within the school themselves, and I'll quote from the report directly. When we asked administrators about the likelihood of allowing their students to use mobile devices for instructional purposes at school this year, it's 2010, a resounding 65% of principals said, no way. Now, school administrators overwhelmingly hold the comforting belief that a transition into this pervasively connected culture can be prevented or forestalled or simply banned. And a decade ago, schools banned the mobile. And within the last few years, schools let the mobile in with all sorts of restrictions around how they can be used. In a few years' time, there's going to be no effective way to silence the mobile anywhere because so much of our children's lives is now becoming contingent on its connectivity. And so, like King Canute, we have to admit to ourselves that we cannot hold back this tide. We have to prepare for the rising waters. We have to learn how to swim in the sea of connectivity, or we're all going to drown. Now, when people connect together, they automatically begin to share. You don't have to teach them to do it. They do it because that's what they want to do. We have an instinctive desire to share with one another matters that we think are important. And so if you give anyone an open channel, they will immediately start to transmit anything that they see that they think could be interesting to anyone else. And at the beginning, when we get connected together, that can look very unfocused. If you think about the number of bad jokes and cute kittens that you see from someone when they first get online. But as time passes, we teach one another the things that we consider are important by sharing those things with the people that we are connected with. Sharing, driven by need and amplified by technology, reaches every one of us through our networks of connections. And we both give and receive. We give according to what we know, and we receive according to what we want to learn. Sharing amplifies our scope of awareness. We can find and we can connect easily to other people who share our interests. And when we do that, we increase our awareness around those interests. The parent-child bond is the most essential human interest. So that means that parents are now loading their children up with the technologies of connection. And they are gaining a situational awareness of their children's lives, which would make them the envy of ASIO. The mobile now becomes a tether of eyes and ears and capability. The child uses the mobile to share experiences, both actively and passively. And the parent, wherever they may be, hovers, watching and guiding. And this helicopter parenting was very difficult to put into practice before we were all connected, because that kind of vigilance required constant presence. But the mobile cuts that cord. It allows parental hypervigilance to become a pervasive feature of the educational environment. And I know that all of you are starting to get a taste of what that feels like. And as the techniques for electronic hypervigilance become less expensive, and as they become easier to use, they become the accepted practice for child rearing. Now, I have a friend who is an anthropologist at Intel. Yes, the people who make chips actually employ anthropologists because they need to study how people are using their devices. So this is Genevieve Bell. She's a fellow at Intel. She's an anthropologist. And she told me about a day that she spent in a South Korean classroom a few years ago. She was interviewing children whose parents had equipped them with GPS tracking mobile phones so that the parents knew where the kids were every single minute of the day. And so Belle asked the kids, "Don't you find the constant monitoring a bit intrusive, a little bit creepy?" And when she asked this, one student pointed to another student and said, "See? She doesn't have one of these mobiles. Her parents don't love her enough to know where she is." So in the context of the parent-child bond, something that seems kind of creepy and Orwellian to us is actually transformed into the ultimate security blanket. I have a friend in Sydney who has a child in kindergarten. He's a very precocious boy, and so he's finding kindergarten alternately boring and confronting. And so she gets called in to speak with the teacher periodically because he's being disruptive. This is disruptive behavior that he blames on the fact that he's being bullied by another boy, but this bullying is happening in a way that the teacher is not seeing it, so the teacher hasn't been able to intervene. And so her son's getting increasingly frustrated. He's dreading every day at school. She was talking to me about this, and I realized that the reason he feels frustrated is because this boy feels alone. He feels undefended in the classroom environment. And I started to think, now how might that change? And I imagined that perhaps before he left for school in the morning, his mom might have fixed a little button to his school uniform, maybe up on the collar, and that button would have a camera, a microphone, and a mobile transmitter in it. And it would continuously record and transmit a live stream directly from the child's collar to the parent's mobile, wherever they might be, all day long. And the child wouldn't have to do anything, because it would simply work. And then my friend would have an awareness of her child wherever they went. And if there was trouble, if there was bullying or anything else, my friend would simply be able to take that section of video and mail it off to the teacher. And this is not science fiction. It's not even particularly far away. Every smartphone has all the technology needed to happen. While I was talking to you, I just Skyped into my office at home, and there's a live picture of my office right now on Skype, because I just set that up before I came down to Melbourne, because I wanted to be able to do this. Making a hole in space and time and finding out what's going on the other side is easy now. It can happen with every smartphone. And last month, as I was writing this talk, I went online and purchased this. This ridiculous-looking watch that I'm wearing is actually a Spinet watch. It's a toy watch for kids. It records 20 minutes of video, although I'm actually using it this morning because it records 2 hours of audio, so I'm recording the audio from this morning's talk. And if my friend wanted to, she could just go online, buy the watch, slap it onto her kid, and say, "Honey, if there's anything that's disturbing you today, just start recording it." They could review it when they got home. And shrinking this down to the size of a button and putting it on the collar. That's just a matter of time and a little bit of engineering. It will come. And when that device hits the market, parents will find it irresistible because it finally gives them eyes in the back of their head. So let's ask ourselves, is this technological tethering a good thing for the parent or the child? Psychologist Sherry Turkle, I hope you're all familiar with her work, because she has done more work around children and technology than any other single human being. So her work is fundamental to this field. And she has been exploring this relationship. She's come to the conclusion that this constant, close connectivity between the parent and child keeps the child from exploring their own boundaries, because they're never outside of the penumbra of the parent, because it artificially extends the helplessness by amplifying the parent-child bond. We tend to forget that connection comes with a consequence, that to be connected is to be affected by how we're connected. So a small child might have an enormous sense of freedom because they're on an electronic tether, but an adolescent might have a dependency on that connection, which then interferes with their adult development. Now, because all of this connectivity is such a recent condition, because it's happened literally over the last 3 or 4 years, we don't have any answers to these questions, but these are the kinds of questions that we need to start to ask. And this connection has broad consequences for educators. 2 years ago, I heard a teacher in Victoria relate the following story. It was a high school classroom. It was a call for homework assignments. And one of the students didn't have their assignment, and this was not the first time that the student had not had done their homework assignment. So the teacher walked up to the student and was starting to have a bit of a go. And as the teacher was haranguing the student reached into his knapsack, took out his mobile phone, pressed a button, "Yeah, hi, you listen to the bitch," and held it up so that they could hear the teacher haranguing. So connection, sharing, both rewire and short-circuit the relationships that we've grown accustomed to in the classroom. How can a teacher maintain discipline when they're constantly being trumped by a child who's tethered to a hyper-vigilant parent? How can a child gain independence while they're so tethered? And how can a parent gain any peace of mind while constantly monitoring the activities of their child? All of these new dynamics are persistent features of the 21st century classroom. They're all already present. None of them are as yet pervasive. And so we actually have time right now, but the moment is right now, to think about the consequence of hyperconnectivity. Now, just about a decade ago, Stanford University and Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is my alma mater, announced something that at the time was considered absolutely revolutionary. They made the decision to publicly post all of their lesson plans, all of their homework assignments, all of the recordings of lecture materials on offer by the school, and they were going to do it free of charge. And so some people immediately wondered aloud, why would I spend $40,000 a year on tuition, which is how much it is at those schools, when you could get the content for nothing, when you could get the content for free? And of course, as educators, you know that the person who asked that question has a fundamental misunderstanding of what education is, particularly in the 21st century, because knowledge is freely available. Mentoring that takes that knowledge and produces from the student comprehension, that mentoring remains a precious resource. So it's wonderful to have a lesson plan. It's essential to work with someone who has a deep understanding of the material. That's the magic in education. That's the je ne sais quoi that makes education a profoundly human experience, an experience that is in some ways stubbornly resistant to automation. We have no shortage of material to work with. We have nearly 4 million articles in Wikipedia. We have 2,500 articles on Khan Academy of different subjects. We have tens of thousands of lessons on everything from cooking to knitting to gardening in YouTube. We have sites like Skillshare, which connect experts who have specialist knowledge to people who want that specialist knowledge. Even with all of this going on, even with this embarrassment of riches, we still long for the ability to breathe the same air, to conspire with the mentor, because we know that a mentor, simply by the fact of their presence, transmits mastery. And when you read that line, it's very mystical. What's actually going on there between the mentor and the student? We don't know. We just know that it works. We have a lot of educational theory, but we don't actually understand other than it's profoundly human moment. Education is arguably the most human of all human behaviors. We don't really understand all of the details. Okay, so who educates the educators? So far, all of the materials that have been created have basically been aimed at the students to make students' lives easier. It helps an educator. Hey, that's nice. It's not really the main game. And so in that sense, all of these educational resources have been profoundly populist. They go directly to the students. They ignore the schools. They ignore the school administrations. And they're able to do that because all of this hyperconnectivity removed all of the friction that was present in getting to students. 20 years ago, teachers were the connection to the students. That's no longer the case. Teachers are connected to the students, but the students are now connected in so many other ways. So that connectivity is connected directly to the students, but so far it's pretty much ignoring the teachers. And this leads to a situation where in the back of a classroom, a student can sit with their mobile and shout out corrections to errors that are in teacher's lecture. Why isn't a teacher able to get peer review of the same material so that their peers can help work that out? Theoretically, that should be easy. In practice, we're mostly still waiting for that. Now, last month, I had the good fortune to be a judge at an event called Sydney Startup Weekend. Technology entrepreneurs come in on Friday evening and they get 1 minute to pitch an idea. The best of those ideas self-select, people form into teams, and they spend 48 basically sleepless hours bringing the idea to life. The winning idea, called Classmate, and it addresses directly the, you're going to like this, educator to educator, or here's the new buzzword, E to E connection.
Jane here is spending precious time creating a worksheet for her class tomorrow. But once the lesson is over, the worksheet gets filed away into a drawer. Jane isn't the only one. Educators all over Australia watch their hours disappear, creating worksheets that may have a similar content to Jane's. Enter Classmate. Classmate allows teachers to access educational resources like the one Jane made online. This means Jane spends less time creating documents, which gives her more time for the other areas of her teaching. Jane can also share the resources that she made, allowing other teachers around the world to access her work and use it in their own classrooms. Through Classmate, Jane may also choose to get paid for her resources. Classmate, a place for teachers to save and share their resources, letting teachers plan less and teach more.
So the core idea here is that teachers should be able to share resources with one another, and they should be able to do it as broadly as they can. Now, it's always been possible to do this, but it's been difficult because there haven't been systems that have been designed specifically around a teacher's needs. But we're at an interesting moment, particularly in Australia, because as the national curriculum rolls out over the next couple of years, its organization becomes a taxonomy for the sharing of lesson plans. You don't just have to sort of go into a Google-like search and come up with hundreds or thousands of lesson plans that you have to go to based on a matching keyword. Rather, you get to something that's very specific and focused, which is drawn from the various nodes in the curriculum. So that with a national curriculum as an organizing principle, rather than a mandate, let's think of it as an organizing principle. The best lesson plans for any particular node will quickly be identified and quickly rise to the top. And if we do that, whether with Classmeet or something else, it means that soon every teacher in Australia will have access to the best class materials from the best teachers throughout Australia. So teachers can spend more time interacting with students and less time actually doing the hard slog of creating materials, which becomes now a shared task rather than a singular burden. But of course, teachers are no different than students. Even the best lesson plan is in itself insufficient. Teachers need to work with other teachers. They need to be mentored by other teachers. They need to conspire with other teachers in order to make their own pedagogical skills commensurate with the resources that we have on offer. So professional development has to go hand in hand with the accelerated sharing of resources, or else sharing is only going to amplify the imbalances between classrooms and between schools. Now, here in Victoria, the Department of Education and Early Childhood Development has put a lot of time, effort, and resources into the Ultranet, which is designed to facilitate the sharing of materials. Now, as someone who is not a student or a teacher or a parent in Victoria, theoretically, I would have never seen the Ultranet. I have seen the Ultranet. I can't tell you how or where. It's a secret. I have seen the Ultranet. And I can tell you that for all that the Ultranet is a sharing platform, it is not very user-friendly. If I were not very well-versed in computers, if I were someone who was essentially hostile to computers, I would not be using the Ultranet because the interface it presents is fundamentally unfriendly. This is because the Ultranet has not fundamentally been designed from the perspective of the teachers or the students who will be using it. It's more been thought about as a series of KPIs on a tick sheet. Okay, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, we've got to do this, without a thought about the actual process involved. And one reason why I think systems like Classmeet, and Classmeet in particular, will do well is because the designer of Classmeet is a third grade school teacher in New South Wales, and he's been confronting this precise problem every day. He's trying to solve it for himself. So once you get sharing between educators, once all of us are sharing information, it creates a broader platform for sharing between students and educators. Now at present, almost all of that sharing happens inside the classroom and it's lost. We need to think carefully about how to capture all of those sharing moments and make them available to students. And you think about the recording device I mentioned earlier. It works nicely for someone in kindergarten, but it becomes even more valuable to someone who's preparing for a VCE. It gives them a record of the mentoring received. The note-taking program that Stephen just showed, imagine now having that in every classroom as you're studying for a VCE, the student taking notes, and they now have a complete audio record of everything that's gone on in the classroom, but not just audio, video, over a year's time, and they can go to any part of it and review any part of any lecture. That's where we have to move to. And once we get there, we can expect that that material will also be shared broadly, so that everything that goes on between the mentor and the student is captured everywhere and shared with everyone. And if that sounds a bit like living in a fishbowl, I'm afraid we're all going to have to get used to that. Educators, in particular, are being hit hard by hyperconnectivity because they spend their days working with students who have never known anything else. Students copy from one another, teachers borrow from other teachers, administrators and departments copy from other schools and other states. That's how it's always been, but now it's no longer difficult to do any of that, and so it's accelerating wildly and transforming the idea of the classroom. Okay, I want to turn now to the curious case of David Sesso, who is a 25-year-old unemployed truckie from Cowra in New South Wales, who was arrested by the Australian Federal Police on a series of charges which could see him thrown in jail for a decade. Now, with nothing but time on his hands and the internet at his fingertips, Cecil found the thing that he was the most interested in. He found the people who shared his interests, and he listened to what they said. The internet became his classroom, and the people he connected to became his mentors. He dedicated himself to learning. He worked as much as 20 hours a day, and he took himself from absolute beginner to practiced expert in just a few months. This is a feat of learning that we could all admire in theory, if not so much in practice, because on the 27th of July, he was arrested at a dawn raid, charged with breaking into and subverting the computers of Platform Networks, which is an internet service provider. You probably heard about the NBN hack. This is the guy, this is the story. And Cecil might have gotten away with it, but his ego what done him, because he went back to the same bulletin boards where he'd learned his elite skills and bragged. Now, these boards are monitored by forces of law and order, so it was really only a matter of time before there was an inevitable arrest. And while it might seem the apex of stupidity to go online and brag about breaking the law, the desire to share what we know and to be seen as being an expert for what we know, that desire frequently overrules our sense of self-preservation. Because we're born to share what we know, and we're wired to learn what others share. That's no less true for ourselves than it is for David Sesso. And now that this figurative internal wiring has become external and has become literal, now that the connections no longer end with our family and our friends and in our classrooms, but extend pervasively and continuously throughout the entire world, we have the capability, in principle, of learning anything known by anyone, anywhere, and of gaining the advantage of experiences to guide us through our own. So we have for the first time the possibility of some sort of collective mind, not in a wacky science fiction sense, but in something so mundane it barely rates a mention today, Wikipedia. It's 3.7 million articles. It's the factual core of human knowledge. It offers it up not necessarily perfectly, but what it lacks in perfection it makes up for in ubiquity. Every person now walking around with a smartphone in their pocket walks around with the collected essence of human knowledge, accessible with a few strokes of a fingertip. And that's unprecedented, because it means that we now have the capability to make better decisions than we ever have before, because at every step along the way, we can refer to this factual base, and we can use it to guide us in doing the best that we can at every moment. Now that's the potential for this moment, but we don't yet operate in those terms. We teach children to research as if this were an activity distinct from the rest of lived experience, when in reality, research is the core activity of the 21st century. If you take nothing else away out of today's talk, please remember that. Research is the core activity of the 21st century. We need to think about an era, which is really just a couple of years from now, when everyone has a very smart and very well-connected mobile in hand from birth. We need to think about how that mobile becomes the lever that moves the child into knowledge. And we need to think about our own practice as educators and how it is both undermined and amplified by the device and by the network that stands behind it. Now, if we had to do this as individuals, or even within a single school administration, we would quickly be overwhelmed by the pace of change outside the school walls. But in order to encounter this accelerating tsunami of connection, we have to take the medicine ourselves. We have to use the same tools as our students and their parents. We have agency here. We can do things, but only when we face the future squarely and admit that everything that we once knew about the logic of the classroom, about its flows of knowledge and power, all of that has gone askew, and our future lies with the network, not in opposition to it. So in 10 years' time, how many administrators will say, "No way," when asked if a mobile has a place in their curriculum? I mean, by then it's going to be the equivalent of asking whether reading has a place in the curriculum. That's the stone that has to be moved, because it's a psychological block. It's damming up the connectivity, and it's creating this weird, dry, artificial lake in what should be a continuous sea of capability. And the longer that dam remains in place, the more force builds up behind it. And either we move the stone ourselves, or the pressures of a hyper-connected world will simply rip through the classroom and wipe it out. So your students are not alone on their journey into knowledge and mastery. Beside them, we as educators are blazing a trail ourselves into close connectivity. We are trying now to develop methods to leverage the depth of collective experience in an accelerated search for solutions. So we must research and search and share and learn and put that learning into practice. And we must do this continuously so that we can stay in front of this transition and we can guide it toward meaningful outcomes for both students and educators. We must reinvent education while hyperconnectivity is reinventing us. Finally, let me play devil's advocate. Connectivity is amazing and wonderful and empowering, and so is its opposite. In 15 years, we have gone from a completely disconnected culture to a completely connected one. And now we believe, sort of a priori, that connection is good. But connection comes at a cost. To be connected is to be deeply involved with another and to be outside of one's own self. And that's fine some of the time. But we also need the space where we are wholly ourselves, where we are contingent upon no one else. Our children, our students, do not know this. The value of silence and quiet seems obvious to us, but they have never lived in a disconnected culture. Being disconnected frightens them, both because it's unfamiliar, but also because it seems to hold within itself the possibility of facing dangers without that lifeline. And this generation has no positive role model of disconnection to look to. They see their parents, who respond to text messages at the dinner table, who answer emails in front of the television at night, who run to the mobile every time it rings. Parents have no boundaries around their connectivity, and by their actions, that is what they have taught their children. And so educators must instill some basic rules, a hygiene of connectivity, into the next generation. We need to highlight disconnection as something that can be longed for, that is a positive feature of life. We need to teach them ways to manage their connectivity so that they become masters of their connections and not servants. And we need to be able to set the example in our own actions. If we do that, we give the next generation an important insight about how to be whole in a hyper-connected world. Thank you. Okay, first off, the URL there goes to my blog, which should, I think, now have the text of that talk up there, I believe. And also, if you want, please come along to the workshop, because I want us to focus on sharing ideas and workshopping ideas around sharing for teachers and students during the workshop today. So please come along. Comments? It's always hard to get yes, Mark.
Mark, there's an interesting point that I think that arises out of the classroom invention that you spoke about, where teachers share information. And it was interesting to hear you talk about teachers sharing worksheets.
Yes.
Will this allow the cream to rise to the top, or mediocrity to prevail?
I think the answer to that is yes. Any rating system is only as good as the people who are doing the rating. And so when you crowdsource a rating system, that's one set of ratings. The other set of ratings is word of mouth. And they're not quite the same thing. So one teacher will see another teacher, oh yes, this worksheet's really great for you, you go get it. Whereas another person will just go on and say, this has the high rating. And so it's not going to be, I think, one or the other. If there's a multiplicity of choices, then theoretically, everyone will always get what they feel is most appropriate to them, theoretically. In practice, we'll have to see. Wikipedia hasn't become more mediocre as time has gone by. If anything, it's become more pedantic as time has gone by. That's not a bad thing, because it's an encyclopedia, and an encyclopedia needs to be pedantic. So I can't answer yes or no. I think the answer is probably going to be both. If you want to go to shared resources that are mediocre, those are going to be there. There's a value in people curating those resources and using those curation networks. Because if you're an individual teacher going out there to go find a resource, then you might only be able to find the individual mediocre resources. But if you're actually part of a sharing network, one of the functions of that sharing network isn't just to generate resources, but it's to help people find the best resources for their needs. So theoretically, the sharing network is an amplifier that helps you find the good things. This is a very good point. I think with a lot of systems, they're going to be commercial options, so you'll be able to license your intellectual property. So I don't think that's going to be a problem. I think that in the 21st century, the future belongs not so much to the actual creation of the intellectual property, but the people who are best able to employ it. It's not so much, I mean, if you become expert at creating intellectual property, people will value you for that. For example, I give almost all of my talks away, but people still pay me lots of money to come and do a talk because they want me in person. So my value has gone up. So there are ways to be able to balance this. The tighter you attempt to control your intellectual property, the more you limit its natural spread. And so there's a fundamental opposition there. And so there's a lot of companies that make, for instance, sheet music and things like this, and you know, music teachers can't copy it, and da-da-da-da-da, and there's a fundamental tension there. And the more resource that's out there in the world, the easier it's going to be for someone else to find another resource that isn't as intellectually protected. And so when you try to assert very strong intellectual property rights, as opposed to, say, weak rights, you're essentially artificially limiting your market. It will work for some people, it won't work for most. Yes.
Just quickly with that intellectual property, I think certainly in most departments and CEOs, you don't have any intellectual property. You know, what you make for work as a teacher belongs ultimately to the department and CEO. Certainly in several states in Australia.
If it's made not during work hours.
If it's made outside of work hours, if it's for your work, it still belongs, to my knowledge, to the department or to the CEO.
Oh, that's interesting.
it gets a bit grey when it's music teachers maybe making things for stuff they do outside.
Okay, well that's interesting. I think because there's never been an effective market for that, it's never been an issue. Now that there's going to be effective markets for it, it's going to become an issue. All right, people will not arbitrarily sign away their intellectual property. So I'm just saying that that's going to be a problem because it's in opposition.
Just quickly, with that hygiene and connectivity, you were saying it's the kind of responsibility of the teachers and the educators. Wouldn't you see it as being a bit bigger than that, but of society, the same with, and like the parents, like with cyber safety?
Yeah.
Should just fall onto the teachers?
Oh, I'm not saying it should solely fall onto the teachers, but it's got to start somewhere. Yeah. And it's, I mean, that's why I made such a point that the parents are teaching the wrong thing right now. And essentially, the school is going to be faced with a dilemma because it's got to let the connected devices in, but it's letting them in on the backs of students that don't have any proper sense of how to use those devices wisely because they aren't getting that in. So I think that that's part of it. So yes, there's no question. And in fact, this is a big point that I'm making in my book, and my book is aimed at the lay public. So big point that I'm making in the book, in the chapter about connection, is this importance of doing the reversal of it. Because, yes, the broader culture needs to be aware of it. We can give ourselves a pass, because this has all only happened in the last 10 years. No one saw it coming. It sucked us all in. If you think about it now, the default social posture in public is this. And it's true for everyone, right? We're just sitting here like this now. We're sucked into our devices, and we need to become conscious of that in order to be able to have another option. So, yes.
Carol Sloan. I've just got a quick question. In terms of, we've got the IP right, we've got teachers who are developing really good digital resources, they're working well in their schools with their students, and you say, listen, can you upload that so it can be shared? Oh no, I can't do that, I don't want to do that. How do you, because they get a little perhaps subconscious that maybe it's not of standard, as was a question earlier.
Right.
And there's a bit of fear about whether or not they will be evaluated, maybe not to their liking. So what do we do to empower teachers to get into that sharing professionally?
You give them as much control over the sharing as possible. And this is Facebook's failures. You upload something and you can't stop how far it goes. One of the things they're designing Classmate for, but should be designed in all systems, that you can either design it just for yourself or to share with a few close colleagues or within a school or within a school system or broader. And if you give a teacher the option to be able to say, yeah, just the people that you know well will be able to see it, they're going to feel a lot more comfortable about that because it's the fear of having people that you don't know come in and judge you around your work. That's probably more of the block there, all right? And the other thing is an option. It's not a mandate, it's an option. And that's how you get people to feel comfortable with it. I think that people, I mean, and this may be a generational thing, where younger people are much more casual about sharing things that are crap, that are incomplete, let's put it that way, that are not polished, right? And older people are more like, well, wait, this is going out to the world, oh my God, you know, as if it's the only thing they're ever going to share. So there's a whole bunch of things there, and I think the way you get around that is by making sharing as intimate as it can be. If it's intimate, then it doesn't feel confronting. All
right.
I'm just interested in what you personally do to try and silence all the silence you need to not be kept.
I meditate daily, and it's a lovely disconnected space. That's where I'm connected to me. I have very good friends in California who are practicing what they call a technology Sabbath, so that from sundown Friday to sundown Saturday, all the devices are turned off. That's it. They go away, they play with the kids, and then they commit. And I mean, I suppose if you've already like agreed to pop over to their house for dinner or something, that'll happen, but you can't call them and reach them and try to negotiate that. So different people have different approaches around this. I take my approach as every day there's some time that's disconnected. I've also started to learn more. I'm very well connected on Twitter, so that I have 22,000 followers on Twitter, and I follow about 7,000 people. And I actually do follow 7,000 people. And I did this to be a bit of a guinea pig for myself. What is it like for a single human being to try to sort of do that? And the one thing that I found is that Twitter is an emotional amplifier. If I'm upset, Twitter can make me more upset. If I'm happy, Twitter can make me happier. And so I've started to be able to recognize in myself when I need to step away from Twitter because it's only making the problem worse. But I learned that the hard way. I learned that by having several very public meltdowns on Twitter. But this is the kind of thing that now that I know that I can sort of bring that into my own hygiene and it becomes part of it. And so I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is what can you do internally as a sort of discipline internally to be able to separate yourself from the constant need to check it for an email or answer a text, or can you do that? How can you build that wall up in yourself? What does that wall feel like? And it's like an exercise that we all need to do a little bit of every day.
Generation where I wasn't allowed to take a calculator into my maths class.
Yeah.
I absolutely wasn't allowed to take a calculator into tests. With high-connected students connected up to the sum total of knowledge on my phone,
right.
What are the implications for assessment and testing, particularly high-stakes testing?
You really want me to go here? I'm happy to go here. That entire framework collapses. You know, it just does. Testing is that in that sense about retention. This is why I say the entire focus of the 21st century is about research. An assessment test in the 21st century is dropping a research question onto a student that they know nothing about and figuring out how quickly they can get mastery on it. All right, that's what the VCE of 2020 or 2030 looks like. It's not, you know, how much have you been absorbed and be able to reflect back about what I taught you about European history. Getting from here to there is not immediately obvious to me. But it's where we need to go, because it's where grown-ups are now. I mean, in that sense, in our jobs, you know, when we need to learn something new, we go and we learn it. So how is it that that's going to be different for our kids? All right. So assessment comes from a particular model where teacher imparts knowledge to students. Well, knowledge coming from everywhere now, teacher helping students into knowledge that's coming from everywhere. So how do you reflect that? Okay. All right, thank you all very much.
Into so many concepts and phenomena that came together. Yeah, you said so many things, but there's just no way that I can do justice.